Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. It's truly a pleasure to be here and talk about an academic community partnership that we have been having in the Detroit metro area for the past 3 years now that we generally call UHIP, United for HIV Integration and Prevention and Policy. And the reason why I'm actually not talking about HIV today and I'm talking about work discrimination is that we often think about individual level correlates of risk without putting the context behind why is it that some kids are having more risk than others. And HIV is one example, but we can think about many other types of health behaviors. I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. And so what I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about what we were trying to do at UHIP, think about what workplace discrimination means. This is particularly salient this week since ENDA is being discussed, and we'll talk a little bit about non-discrimination and its effects on health. I'll show you some data that actually just I got the proofs today and have sent out. This paper is getting published in Sexuality Research and Social Policy, so I'm happy to send that along. And also then think about how do we start moving forward and removing workplace discrimination as a public health strategy. So usually when I talk about Detroit Metro, automatically the assumptions and stereotypes about Detroit come up. I think the media has done a terrible job of contextualizing the lived experience of people in Detroit and surrounding areas. So I'm going to tell you a little bit of what happens and what doesn't get told. The city of Detroit proper is constituted by predominantly an African-American populace, 80% of the population, with a very vibrant workforce. So there's 20% of the city population actually is between the ages of 18 to 29. A third of the populace lives under the poverty line, and we have a huge unemployment rate as compared to other cities, right, with a 15%. And these are the common stereotypes of what you hear about. But what we don't really talk about is the protective things that the city and other surrounding areas are doing. So lo and behold, even though the state of Michigan does not protect LGBT populations from work discrimination, the city of Detroit and other surrounding areas have included in their policies sexual orientation and at sometimes gender expression and identity as categories or classes that should not be discriminated in the context of trying to find a job. Without a federal protection, however, it's really hard for some of these policies and laws to be enforced, and many people actually don't even know that these policies are in place, especially young adults. So we can think about sexuality discrimination in two different ways. We can think about the systemic silence that LGBT populations suffer, and the lack of federal non-discrimination laws is clearly the best example of that silence. But you can also think, okay, well, when the federal government figures out what they're going to do, can the states start doing something in their own jurisdictions? And even there, we're actually seeing either a desire to silence those protections or to actually rule them out as a potential category in the future. There are only 21 states and D.C. that actually have protections based on sexual orientation. And when you then start stratifying sexual orientation with gender identity and expression, that number starts becoming smaller and smaller. System-wise, that makes sense, but how does it actually end up affecting us as a population? Well, if there is no recourse for having been violated your human rights, then it's much more easy or forgivable or even to pass a particular social event as normative when in fact it's prejudicial or there's victimization tied to it. So the data that I'm going to show you today is part of this larger study. We did a survey of 426 young men who have sex with men and trans populations. Now, the trans data is so small and limited that I've excluded it from this conversation, but if any of you are doing advocacy work and would like access to this data, talk to me. So I'll focus on the 397 participants who self-identify as cis male and who have sex with men. The mean age was 23. To be eligible, you had to be between the ages of 18 and 29. And we had quite a diverse racial ethnic composition with almost half of the sample reporting being black or African American, a quarter being white Caucasian, 15% Latino, and 9% as other. What's curious is that, contrary to popular belief, people seem to think that youth in Detroit don't have a high school education or in surrounding areas. And our sample, actually, whenever I show this, people go like, wait, you must have a highly educated sample. 90% of your participants have a high school or GED. Turns out that if you look at the census data for the city of Detroit, the likelihood of having completed a high school education or GED is really high. And I think the conversation we need to start having is the quality of the education. And we can talk about that in the questions and answers if you want. That's a different talk. But we also have to think about the context of, so who's working and not working. So close to two-thirds of our sample reported either working full-time currently or working part-time. The median income is $12,000. And when we then start adjusting for number of people in the household, we actually see that 45% of our participants live under the federal poverty line. We also ask them questions on residential instability. So in the past 30 days, did you not have a place to sleep? And 7% of the sample said that this had been an issue for them in the past 30 days. Now, we had one question, and I keep hitting myself over the head about this. We only had one health insurance question. And so we said, oh, do you have any form of health insurance? And over half said that they did have it. Now, what we don't know now is if it's private health insurance or if it was Medicaid, Medicare, or social services offered to them as youth. So what I'm doing here is I'm showing you the descriptive data for four different metrics of health that come from the quality of life survey that the CDC uses. The first one is the self-reported health outcome. And this actually has been shown to be highly correlated with morbidity and mortality. So even though it's a subjective measurement of how you think your health is doing, it tends to be quite reflective of how well you're going to be doing soon. And so as you can see, we have the majority of people saying they're somewhere between good and excellent, although we're already starting to see some people say they're poor or fair with regard to their health. Most people said that at least one day in the past 30 days, their physical health had not been good. We also find that actually in the context of mental health, close to 4 days were days in the past month where mental health was not good. And then when we look at limited functionality, we start seeing that close to 10% of the sample has already said that I have some type of impairment or health function concern that doesn't let me navigate my life perfectly. And I'll come back to that 9% in a second. So we had this huge set of questions regarding types of discrimination, and given the policy conversations that are happening both in our state and federally, we wanted to really focus on this context of work discrimination. So we had three different measures for work discrimination, and we asked youth in the past year whether they had been denied or fired from a job because of their sexual orientation, whether they felt that they had been denied a promotion or a raise because of their sexuality, or received a work evaluation that was unfair. Now, if you put all those categories together, we actually see that 15% of our participants reported in the past year one of these events happening to them. And when you tally the possibilities, we see that 10% reported at least one type, 3% report at least two types, and close to 2% report all three forms of discrimination. Thank you. So what I've done here is I've included a multivariate regression model trying to look at the association between different social considerations and characteristics and participant self-rated health, and what I really want to point you to is this idea of work discrimination. We actually are using work discrimination there in the context of cumulative exposure of discrimination, so it's not a yes-no. It basically tells you that for every additional experience of work discrimination, your health went down by 0.16, which in effect sizes is a small effect size of close to 0.10. And that is after adjusting for your sexual identity, your race ethnicity, your employment status, whether you had health insurance, and your HIV status, and residential instability. And so I'll leave this for the question and answer, I do want to leave this in your head that residential instability seems to have its own relationship with health, just like work discrimination. But what we haven't tested right now is how are those things going on? So could it be that the kids who actually are trying to get a job and not getting it because of their sexuality are also the kids who are being more transient or economically distressed? For sake of time, I'm showing you this other one, which is now it's an odds ratio logistic regression of whether youth had reported limited functionality. And I'm really picky with my statistics. So I will be the first to tell you that even though it's significant at 0.05, this work discrimination variable, the confidence interval includes 1. And the reason why is it's, the P is 0.052. So even if you round down to 0.05, it's there. Now, even that being said, exposures of work discrimination increases the likelihood of you being one of the participants who said that you had limited functionality. And I remind you that that was actually 10% of the sample. So even under a low probability of being in this group, we still are seeing a relationship between work discrimination and health. So, I am not talking as a faculty member at the University of Michigan because I am not allowed to talk about specific laws or policies under that role, so I'll talk as a private citizen for a second. This is the week to call your representative and senator and talk about ENDA. It is being heard, it's being discussed, and the president has already said that if it comes forward, he will sign it. ENDA basically would prevent discrimination of sexual minorities if the business has at least 15 employees. So be active, be public health, call. Okay, now back to faculty role. Thank you. Beyond the federal legislation, I think it's really important that we also start mobilizing as a community to talk about state-level policies and rules. So if calling your federal representative is daunting, call somebody more local and ask that they either at the regional level or at the state level, state employment protections are put in place. I think that even if those policies are put in place, we all know that we need to do something so it trickles down to the day-to-day operation. So I'm proposing that we start thinking about how can we do cultural sensitivity and humility programs at the workforce so that we promote non-discrimination and stereotypes with regards to both sexual orientation and gender identity and expression. And that we really think through how structural conditions are influencing some of these work discrimination processes and health, right? So my hope is that many of you will become interested in work as a social process that could actually explain some of the disparities. And I have to acknowledge my community partners who are wonderful, AIDS Partnership Michigan, HARC, Detroit Latinos, and Ruth Ellis Center, as well as our funders, who are the MAC AIDS Fund and Ford Foundation. Thank you.